And with me today is someone who's been around Street Photography Magazine a few times during its history, and it's Michael Ernest Sweet. Michael is, he's originally from Montreal, but he lives in New York now, lives in Manhattan. And, at least he's working in Manhattan. He works full-time as a school teacher, but he spends a lot of time as a photographer as well. And I encourage you to go back and look at some of our previous articles with him and about him, and you can see his development or how he's been changing. And he's here to talk about some new things that he's working on. So, Michael, welcome. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Yeah, well, it's really good to talk to you again. It's been a few years. And it's always nice to circle back with people and see what they're up to, because if you're growing in photography, that means you're changing, and it's good to see how people are changing. So what have you been up to lately?
Well, it's quite a long story, actually. I was away from street photography for a while. That's the first thing I would point out. I think I took a pretty solid year break. I was pretty heavily involved in many aspects. I worked on a documentary that came out. I shouldn't say I worked on. I was featured in a documentary that came out on Gary Winogrand, All Things Photographable. It is called. Although I only appear very briefly in the end production of that, it was a little bit more involved in the process leading up to it. And I was judging for World Street Photography, organization, their contests. I was writing for, and still am, I guess, writing for Photo Life magazine, although a little less frequently now. I was writing for HuffPost Photo. I was deep into it, and I just became tired of, seeing a lot of repetition, visual repetition in the genre, and it was hard to get excited. My own work, and I'll throw myself under the bus here as well, my own work was very repetitive. I think one of the trappings that you get involved in when you sort of develop a style, so to speak, a recognizable style, is that then you become a slave to that style. You try to make something different, and no one knows that it's yours. No one cares. No one is interested. They want to see that Michael Sweet photo, that I became known for, that look. So, but I just couldn't do that anymore. That was done for me. What I had to say in that style was finished. So I took a break. I was away for a while, and then I came back in fits and spurts. I did a little work with disposable cameras for a while. I did work on and off with a toy camera called a Harinazumi, a Japanese plastic digital toy camera. In fact, I produced a book, Michael Sweet's Coney Island, that was made entirely with that camera. and I'm still using that camera right now, the current work that I'm doing. I'm not doing a lot of work right at this moment, but I'm doing some. And it's street photography, so to speak, but it has some distinct differences. The photos are somewhat abstract. There's a lot of motion blur in the photos. They're shot with a very cheap digital toy camera. They're lo-fi feeling to them. And then I do some digital, very whimsical digital drawing or outlining, just a few lines and so on top of those images. And I'm kind of developing a series. I'm titled Primary Colors, because I'm using blue, red, and yellow to draw on these photos. And we'll see where that goes. It's very, very early stages, but that's what I'm working on right now. So that's a long story. I apologize for a long-winded response, but that sort of brings us up to date.
Yeah, no problem at all. It's good to know what's going on. So you've been doing some judging. Yeah, I have too. That's always interesting to do.
It is. The organization is based in Germany. The guy who runs this, and it's largely a profit of love for him. it's not, doesn't make a lot of money. They do publish a hardcover book every year, which I think helps, with some of the expenses of keeping the site up and operational and so on. But I do the judging, I'm not paid for doing the judging there, and that's fine. I do it to also give back to the community. And it is interesting. It becomes interesting and frustrating at the same time. Those competitions are very, very vast. Often, I just did one actually a couple of weeks ago, and I think there was in the range of 2,000 photographs.
Yeah, that's a lot.
In that one, and it takes time to look through 2,000 photographs. In some, of course, I know right away within fractions of a second that it's not going to be a photo that's going to make it into my last round of consideration. So that speeds things up a little bit, but we still rate every single photo for internal purposes. We put a rating on every photo, so I have to look at it long enough to sort of give it a rank. And then I also look at photos long enough to sort of respect the photographer and the fact that someone has deemed this worthy of entering into a contest. I think that the least we can do as a judge is stop and think about maybe why someone entered this photograph. So that is quite a significant task, but I do enjoy seeing what people are doing, and this is one of the best ways to see what's out there and what's going on. And I think the other thing on the frustration side, as I alluded to, is that I see so much repetition in street photography today, and I fear that it's not always pushing us forward as much as maybe we should be pushed forward. I think that there's always been a conversation between photographers. Certainly my own work, my early work, the work that most people know of mine, the, human fragment, black and white stuff, is not completely original in any way. You can see the influence of Mark Cohen immediately in the work, for example. But yet, no one would ever mistake one of my photos for one of Mark's or vice versa. So the work is in conversation, but it's not a copy. Today I just see a lot of copy, people really trying to reproduce photos that they've seen others, have some success with. So a modern example that comes to mind right away is Siegfried Hansen, a German photographer I'm sure you're familiar with, does a lot of street photography with lines and geometrical shapes and now this is everywhere. I see everybody making Hansen photography. And I'm just not sure that I like that. I think I would like to see more fresh takes on things. And so every time I judge a contest, I sometimes say to myself, well, that's it, I'm not going to do another one. But then I always somehow end up doing another one. And every time I do one, I end up, the work that I place in the top, five photographs from the contest is always something different and unique and refreshing and enjoyable. So I guess it all comes with the territory.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Like you, I look at lots of photographs and I see basically a lot of the same image repeated over and over. And that's true with my own photography as well, which is why you don't see me entering any contests anytime soon. But there is. I mean, is there anything original anymore?
In some sense, I think it goes back to that idea that, we are always in conversation with someone before us. excuse me. But I do think you can, have a unique take and add something of your own to the work. This is not an easy thing to do, by the way. And I don't mean to suggest that it is, but I do think it's possible. Again, referencing my own work, and I do that only because I don't want to talk critically about other people's work, or make assumptions too much about other people's work. So again, in using my own work, if we look at that early stuff, that was a confluence of many things that produced that sort of unique look that, you know, you can see the photograph on the wall and people who know my work know instantly that that is my work. That's the thing you want to go after. And that was a confluence of many things. It was time, it was place, it was my visual aesthetic, yes. I was getting in close, I was cropping off bits and pieces of people, the face is not usually present in the photograph, things like that. But it was also other more trivial things too. For example, the camera I used to produce that body of work, which was a Ricoh GR Digital 4, was a very unique camera. It's no longer produced. I mean, you can still get them, of course, but it was no longer produced. It was a camera that made very unique looking photographs. If I grabbed any other camera and went out on the street and tried to make some of that work, it wouldn't work. So it had to be that camera. It had to be the particular software and presets I used in processing. It had to be the particular time and place where the photographs were made. And my own personal vision and energy behind the camera had to be present and had to be the same. So, yeah, it's not easy. But I would like to think that photographers can still sort of arrive at a unique combination of these factors to produce work that will have their own signature. I think that is still possible. Yeah.
Yeah, I think most people struggle with finding their own voice, even over a long period of time.
Yeah, and I think it's partially because of that that idea that it has to be a number of pieces that have to fall into place. What happens today, I see most of the time anyway, is in street photography, someone goes out and buys a camera and then hits the street and pushes the shutter button. And so if everyone is doing that very simple process, we even often tend to use the same cameras, then ultimately in some ways you're going to get the same kind of photographs. If we all grab a Leica Q and we all go into the street and we all take photos of the lady with the umbrella, yes, you know, we're going to see work that is strikingly similar, but that's why I think it's important that photographers have a more intimate relationship with their equipment, for example, than just, it's the new and greatest Leica. That's the one I need to have because that's the one one should have if they're serious about photography. I think that's kind of a trap. And people who get into that trap are going to pay the price in their work. So find a camera that is, you know, that you can have a more intimate relationship with. You know, I used disposables for a while. They have a very, very unique aesthetic. And then a disposable in my hands, given the way that I frame photographs and the way I, you know, the subject matter that attracts me and so on, all combined to make my disposable camera series at least somewhat unique. I won't, you know, ever say that anything I do is completely, you know, original. But I think it's somewhat unique for those reasons. So, yeah, you know, we need to get away from, it is a struggle, but we need to look at all the factors that go into, and I think one of the best ways to do this, by the way, is to study a lot of photography that has come before you and study it intimately and study it from an art history perspective and understand the work that your work speaks to and how you can then make that different with your own angle. Becomes a little bit easier. And today, I think there's not a lot of that. I think a lot of photographers look at other amateur photographers. And so you're in an echo chamber of sorts. And that's going to be a very tough environment to make or find a signature. So broadening your background in terms of art history, broadening your approach to equipment, and having a personal relationship with the subject matter that attracts you will all help push someone forward in finding a signature. But it's hard work.
It's an interesting point about the echo chamber. I think avoiding echo chambers or silos are very helpful in a number of aspects of life. And I didn't think of it in terms of photography, of art, but it certainly makes a lot of sense. Because
certainly social media, I think, has impacted this. And so it becomes very easy, I think, to get caught in that. We go to social media very naturally to look at photographs. And we don't see photographs often, and nor should we, because often we don't have people from previous periods actively on social media. A lot of the greats, for example, are no longer with us. That doesn't mean people don't repost Winogrand photos or don't repost Cartier-Bresson photos on social media, but those are not the images that we typically see. So our exposure, and I think particularly younger serious amateurs in the younger age range, are just not getting the exposure to the wealth of history. And even if they do go out and they buy some books, or they do go out and they dig up some more classical photography, you know, street photography, then the next trapping is they tend to get stuck in four or five people that hover around the top in terms of notoriety or notability. And that work is only so diverse as is the number of people. So you really have to dig, and you really have to dig hard. University of Texas Press sent a book for me to review just recently by a gentleman named Ralph Gibson, who somehow never came up on my radar before. And looking through that book, I was very interested because a lot of the work spoke to my work. And I learned more about myself, my own photography, my own vision by looking through that book. Gibson is still alive, but he's, you know, an old man. And the work, much of the notable work, was produced quite some time ago. And, you know, that's not something I was ever going to find on social media, I don't think. And so I think that speaks to the importance of getting out of this digital echo chamber.
Your comments are very timely, at least for me, because I resolved not too long ago to spend more time studying the work of others and studying the work of past photographers, also studying the work of painters. And I'll ask you a question, especially since you're an educator. What would be 3, 4, 5 good books or good past photographers to pay attention to, aside from the obvious ones like the Americans?
Street photography tends to be dominated in a lot of ways by either Americans or people who've spent time in America. I also think, I mean, I'll speak a little bit more broadly maybe than specific individuals. And I will say that, Japanese school is certainly worth looking into. There's a very different approach. There's a very different aesthetic that one sees in the Japanese school. So, you know, digging into that would be, I think, interesting for people. And I think digging in beyond Daido Moriyama, and others like that, getting just a little bit deeper in, there's some women, for example, Japanese women of the mid-20th century that did some interesting work. And then, of course, you know, when we do look back in terms of American street photography, it goes to looking just a little bit below the people who immediately come to mind. You know, Robert Frank, for example, is, of course, important. And it's good to look at his work. Gary Winogrand, very different from Robert Frank. Also important to look at William Klein, Mark Cohen, Joel Meyerowitz, who just ran into the other day on the street.
Really?
Yeah, he's not doing much photography, street photography, I don't think, anymore. But I just ran into him in the grocery store, actually. And
hey, he has to eat too, you know, right?
Nice guy. Yeah, yeah. You know, looking at their work, broadly speaking, and then sort of, connecting the dots or following the garden path or whichever analogy you want to use, you start looking at some of these guys, they will lead to other guys and hopefully women, because we do have women street photographers and we have had women street photographers. So, you know, winding your way through various people and winding your way back in time as you go, I think is important. The other thing I will say is that, and you sort of hit on this, is that art, fine art, painting, can also be very informative. So getting, you know, just standard art history textbook, you know, art history 101, and be, at least at the very minimum, becoming familiar with the names and the styles and the aesthetics that come up in an art history 101 class, I think is not only indispensable, but I think I would even say necessary for a good photographer. I think you have to have that much of a grounding if you're really gonna push your work forward. And it's not, again, it's not about copying anyone who's come before you. It's about understanding why and how you're not copying someone. Interestingly, I do see once in a while some young, arrogant amateur street photographer that puts something forward and says, look at this, isn't this fantastic and unique and different? And, you know, and I look at it and think, well, actually, you know, it's very much like so-and-so. Are you aware of that? And often, you know, and of course I don't say that to them, but I'm just saying often I think some of these people are not aware of the fact that their work is strikingly similar to previous or prior work in art history. And isn't that somehow important?
Let me back up a little bit. I've been studying Andre Kurdish, and I'd looked at some of his photographs, some from like in New York during his period in New York, and I think, yeah, I've seen that before. I've seen that before. And then I realized, hey, wait a minute. He's the first one who did that. And everybody else who came along afterwards was copying him.
Right.
But that was the first time it was done.
Yeah, it's like when you look at Bruce Davidson's subway work. You know, it's great. New York City, iconic New York City subway photographs. You know, his work is great. And it's great in a lot of ways because he was one of the pioneers down in the subway with a camera. Today, somebody I was talking to recently was telling me a story, and I, you know, won't use any names because it was, you know, to protect the innocent, but, you know, very high-profile photo editor or gallerist or someone here in New York City agreed to look at someone's work, and this guy was also somewhat relatively high-profile. Street photographer, contemporary street photographer in New York, and got there, opened the portfolio, and the first several pages were of subway photography, and the guy closed it right away and pushed it back toward him and said, you know, come back to me when you have something that's original. And you know, they may have been kind of rude, but the point was, listen, I've seen every subway photograph I need to see. I need something else, you know, bring me something else. And I think that as harsh as that was, and the guy went away with his, you know, tail between his legs.
The
rest of the story doesn't end so well. You know, he's very distraught and was going to give up photography entirely and all these kinds of things. But I think after the dust settled, maybe, you know, he actually learned a, maybe painfully, but actually learned a very good lesson. And that is that, if you really do want to rise to the top in this game, A, it's not going to be easy, and B, you're not going to do it unless you can figure out how to show me something in a way that I have not seen it before. And like I said, that's hard work. I mean, that's why everybody has a camera in their pocket today. Everyone in that way is a photographer today, and yet virtually no one is a photographer in the true sense, because there's a great divide between having access to a camera in your pocket and being able to make a photograph and getting your name on the map as a photographer. It's a huge, huge gulf, and has only been complicated and made perhaps even huger by that increased ubiquitousness of the camera. I think that that this is not an easy game, which is why I consider every year or so giving it up. Someone said I retire like Ozzy Osbourne retires. but this is the struggle of the artist in general, right? We produce something that is successful, and then we produce a lot of things that are not, trying to get that one successful thing again. And there's a lot of emotional and mental, and in the case of street photography, even physical turmoil that unfold before you hit on something again.
Yeah, I think you have to be comfortable with failure in order to do better.
Yeah, you do. The era that we currently live in the way that social media and social interaction via technology has unfolded, it's not a particularly, and I don't mean to imply that it ever was, but it's particularly visibly and viscerally harsh these days, I think. Failure and criticism. Everyone's a critic. Everyone has, a quote, in their humble opinion, end quote, to share with us. The opinions aren't that humble, as a matter of fact. Usually less so when they're prefaced with that. To continually put yourself out there and to put your work out there and have it exposed to, anonymous, hidden faces that are lashing out at you, takes quite thick skin. Absolutely. And it just becomes a question of how much does one want to put themselves through in order to get to the end point.
You basically were away from street photography for about a year. And how has that affected your work now that you came back to it? Or how has it changed after being gone? And I think it's always a good idea to take time off from really anything.
Yeah, I would agree. Somebody famous once said, I don't remember who, which is why I use the famous saying. Someone famous once said that it mm-hmm. takes 7 years to master a thing. I was at it for 7 years, and then that's when I hit the wall. And did I master the thing? Well, I'll leave that to others to figure out. But I certainly finished the thing. I certainly felt a sense of completion in terms of this is what I have to give to this genre of street photography. This is my contribution. And I was very content with that. I was very content with the body of work that I put forward, namely in my book, The Human Fragment. That is, whatever it is worth, something or nothing, whatever it is worth, that will be, I think, what stands the test of time with my name on it. And so once I became comfortable with that, then my approach changed entirely. I make street photographs now for the simple fun and joy of it. And a lot of people will say that's what I should have been doing from the very beginning. But I don't know that any artist worth their salt really works in that way. I think you're driven by something more than that when you produce good art. And certainly I was driven by more than that, but not anymore. Now I really don't care who likes or doesn't like the work that I'm making. I don't take it very seriously. Hell, I'm using a 3-megapixel piece of plastic the size of a cigarette mm-hmm. package. That's what I make my photographs with. And then I draw all over them after that. It's just, it's fun. It's whimsical. It's irreverent. It's ephemeral. It's just what I'm doing at the moment. And with all that other pressure removed, you know, it feels great. And someday if this work, you know, fits together as a coherent body of work and, you know, ends up between two covers, then that's great. By the way, you know, I should say I'm primarily a book photographer. I don't pursue exhibitions at all. I don't approach galleries. I don't try to sell prints. I work with one commercial gallery in Paris that sells prints of my work. But they do the printing and, you know, they do the sales and I just get a check. And I'm not even, it is good. They actually do quite a few sales. But I don't, even like that arrangement really. So all of that to say, a lot of the outlets for work to take on a permanent life, I don't even pursue. The stuff I'm making right now, I stick it on, Instagram. I just recently went back to Instagram with a new account and, I'm just having fun just sharing it on there and that's it. That's all there is to it at the moment. And that's fine. You know, that's being content with that is interesting for me because that was never the case. I was always, driven by much more serious ambition than that, but not now. So a lot of the, And you know, maybe I'm a little young to think like that, and maybe someday I will return to something more serious, or maybe I won't. But for right now, that's what it is.
You used a term earlier in our discussion, a vision and an energy. And so if you're out and about shooting and you just don't, the vision's not there, the energy's not there, do you just pack up and go home for the day, or is there a way to rejuvenate that while you're working?
Yeah, so I do a number of things. I take a number of approaches. I mean, normally I don't even pull out a camera unless, these days at least, unless I feel that energy, unless I feel that excitement to make some photographs. In the old days, you know, and I was doing both the bodies of work that appear in my books, it was a little bit more of a serious approach in the sense that, you know, I would set the clock the night before. I get up, I'm going out today. As a teacher by profession, I, you know, have a lot of holidays. It's one of the nice things we have in that profession. And so in the summer months particularly, you know, it was my full-time job. I would become a street photographer, you know, full-time. And so I'd get up in the morning. It's like I was going to work, but not anymore. Now I only get the camera out if I feel that. So I never have to force feel that. You know, some writer once said, I only write whenever I'm inspired. I just make damn sure I'm inspired every morning. I don't do that so much anymore. But, you know, one thing I do a lot of now, and I think does help, is I take breaks from the camera. And when I take those breaks, I mean, I'm still in New York City, I'm still out on the street, I mm-hmm. photograph with my mind. I make pictures in my head. And I enjoy both the frustration of and the enjoyment of seeing a good photograph and not having a camera in my hand. It's an interesting experience. I would challenge someone who's a serious, engrossed street photographer to go out for a day and leave the camera at home. Do everything else you would normally do, but leave the camera at home. And it will re-energize you in some way. It's hard to explain, but it will. I think it also sharpens perspective and visual perspective, especially. Sometimes I even make notes. I will just jot down notes or diary style entries about the photographs that I saw that I didn't photograph. So that's been useful to me. And then, you know, I just grab the camera when it feels right.
I talked to somebody else who's using that. I forget who it is. But you're right. I mean, we all buy commercial cameras, right? You know, we're subject to advertising. Mm-hmm. I mean, would you recommend somebody use, you know, keep searching to find the right camera for them, or just use what they've got and use it in their own unique way? Or they're not, I'm sure they're not exactly mutually exclusive, but...
So, yeah, that's what I was going to say. I don't think they are. I think both things are good pieces of advice. Certainly, I wouldn't be afraid to drop a camera and take on another one. But in this day and age, given, you know, the marketing ploys that we're subjected to, I would also be careful with that, because you don't want to just waste time and money riding the camera train. But at the same time, if the camera that you have is not doing it for you, I will say this. I will say that very different energy, very different approaches to making photography come with different cameras. And I could not make one body of my work with another camera. You know, so the camera I'm currently using, I could not make work that looks like my old work. It just, no matter how I use that camera, it cannot produce that work. And vice versa. I, you know, if I was using the Ricoh GR4, which made, you know, pretty traditionally normative, crisp photographs, and then tried to draw on them, the aesthetic for me is not right. You know, I'm taking a very sharply made, crisp photograph and then drawing on it with an electronic pen. It doesn't work for me. It needs to be that blurry, low resolution hint of an image that I approach with the digital pen. That works. So all of these factors again come together to make a good situation. And then you got to keep spinning the wheel. You got to keep trying new combinations. I have always had a good affinity with cheap cameras, cameras that are not too serious. I've owned lots of fancy cameras, Hasselblad, Leica M's, but I've never produced much with any of them. You know, Leica M, for example, is always too damn heavy. I was never interested in carrying a camera around that was, you know, I remember my old M6, put it around your neck and take your head off. They weren't right for me. They didn't give me the right energy. Someone else, of course, taking, I say cheap, although Harina Zoomies are now, you know, they're hundreds of dollars now because they've gone out of production and they have a cult following. So they're getting very expensive, but certainly they are cheaply made. And so you take this little tiny plastic camera with a little tiny plastic lens and a 3-megapixel sensor, and give it to probably just about any other photographer, and they won't be able to do anything with it, and they won't be interested in doing anything with it, and that's fine. So you get what works for you. I would just encourage photographers not to get too hung up on the brand loyalties, or too hung up on the fact that Gary Winogrand wandered around with a Leica, so therefore I must need to do that in order to produce good, lasting classical photography. You know, a lot of people used, just as an aside, something that I wish more people realized. A lot of people used Leica 35 millimeter cameras because they lasted forever. And people who were putting thousands of rolls of film through the camera, like Winogrand, for example, like a lot of press photographers and so on, you know, Leica was worth it as an investment because you couldn't wear the thing out. Today, that's changed completely. Leica has enjoyed the same reputation, but yet it doesn't transfer in the digital age. Now you buy a Leica, it's still going to be outdated in 3 or 4 years, the same as the Sony or the whatever other brand, except you're paying Leica prices. So you want to be sure that that's the camera for you, that that's the camera you need to do your best work. Otherwise, I would say maybe look at something not so expensive that might even allow you to produce.
But unfortunately,
more unique
many
work.
Of us, like you say, they're on the camera train.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's a common trapping for people that are first getting involved in photography. I understand it. I went through it myself. I was not immune to it. Today, one of the best remedies for it is, you know, I'll go over to B&H and take a walk through Disneyland, looking at cameras. And by the time I'm done in the store, I usually have no desire to actually own anything that I just looked at. So I get it out of my system. And then I go on with whatever I'm using, which, like I say, today is exclusively that little piece of plastic. And I'm not, I'm not hiding it, or I'm not ashamed of it or anything. It's my camera. It makes
work. How did you happen to decide this was the camera for you, at least for now?
Just experiments. I've used, I don't even know, I want to say hundreds, of course, that's an exaggeration. But I've definitely, in a very real sense, used a couple of dozen cameras over my sort of career in photography, and work that has stuck around has only come from 3 or 4 of them. So you work with a camera for a while and you realize, oh, I'm not making anything with this that is interesting or unique or permanent for me. And at some point you realize that it may not only, I'm not blaming the camera exclusively. Remember, it's a combination of things, but getting that one element out and swapping in a different element could be all it takes to then start making the work that you are more happy with keeping and showing and publishing and so on. So it was just trial and error with me, with one small caveat, and that is that I don't like complex cameras. Of course I can figure out how to use just about any camera with enough time and whatever it takes. I can figure it out. But I don't like it. So I'm drawn to cameras that I can just point and shoot. And that frees me up for the act of seeing and the act of thinking. I'm not getting bogged down in sub-menus. I'm not getting bogged down in settings. I'm not thinking too much about camera speed and ISO and this and that beyond some very basics that, you want some blur, you slow down the shutter, whatever. But I really have always tried to avoid all of that stuff. And again, if you want to be a landscape photographer, you want to be a portrait photographer, these things may or may not, but they likely will be harder to escape. But for the type of work that I've settled into making, at least at this point in my life, the cheap, uncomplicated, simple consumer kind of even toy or disposable type of camera has suited me well. But it was a trial and error process that got me there.
So where are you going with all this? What's your next move? What's your next step?
That is a good question. I don't really know. And as I alluded to earlier, I'm not too worried about that. I think that it's going to just take its own course. I wouldn't be surprised if I shelve a camera again in the fall when I get back to the classroom and start teaching. It becomes harder to go out and produce photographs. And so I might be, given that I approach it much more lightheartedly these days, I might be more susceptible to just shelving the camera, and it could sit there until next summer. I think that I will also wait and see how, you know, see if anyone's interested in the stuff that I'm currently making, see where that goes. Certainly, I don't think I'm the first person to draw on photographs with a digital pen. But I hope that some of my personality comes through in the things, in the way that I draw on those photographs. And so, you know, I just made one, for example, yesterday, which is just a very sort of ordinary photograph of two women walking down the street, but I drew on their hairstyles with a yellow pen. And the hairstyles that I drew on are very whimsical and cartoonish. And that's working for me right now. That's giving me pleasure to, I find it fun and funny. And so, but if no one else finds it interesting or fun or funny, then I suppose at some point I won't either, or I won't to the point where I will, you know, keep producing it. And I think that's always an interesting struggle for an artist. You know, you hear people say, well, you don't produce work for others. You if you're true to your art, you produce it for yourself, or you produce it for its own sake, or something along those lines. And I think, as noble as that is, I'm not sure that really good artists actually do that. Some, maybe Emily Dickinson comes to mind, for example. I mean, was able to write poems and put them under the mattress and continue to write them. So it's possible. But then people like Andy Warhol come to mind. You know, if he didn't get some attention for a piece of art right away, that was the end of it, and on to the next thing. It was an ego-driven practice, and I think that there's nothing to be ashamed of in being ego-driven as an artist, because I think the ego is a very integral part of making art. And so, to come back around, I think what I'm trying to say is that, you know, or ask is, am I able to continue making art that no one has any interest in? I don't know. Probably not. I'll probably tire of it and try the next thing. I also have some interest in seeing if I can produce some portraits. I haven't tried it. I obviously don't have a camera that's appropriate for it anymore. But I think at some point in my future, whether it's in a year or in 10 years, I'm going to get a rather serious grown-up camera and go into a studio and, you know, learn how to make portraits, because I'm very interested in, I like looking at portraits, and I'm very interested in the human psychology of portrait making. And I want to try my hand at manipulating the human element that exists in the art of making a portrait. Yeah, no, I just was going to say, I think that is somewhere.
It'd be interesting to see how what you've done in the past influence your portrait style.
you mean, will half the face be missing? You know,
who knows?
Possibly. But in my mind's eye, I imagine myself to make much more ordinary in that way, at least. Portraits, you know, like very traditional sort of approach is the type of approach that I imagine myself taking. Of course, I want to have my own presence in the result, but I think you'll see a lot a lot more traditional looking approach when I eventually get around to that work. If, you know, if I ever do, maybe it'll be one of these projects that I do in my head. I've had a lot of those.
Tell us where can people see more of your work?
So right now, as I said, I am just really mm-hmm. putting my work on Instagram and enjoying looking at other people and their work as well through that. It's too bad that we have to look at it at such a minute size, but it is what it is. And so even my website at the moment, I don't have a website at the moment. I don't have any active projects that are serious enough to be bothered with a website. So my website, you know, Michael Sweet Photography, just redirects to my Instagram page. And so that's the best place to go to see both old work. I post some old work on there, and also what I'm currently doing can be seen on there. My two books are still both in print. The Human Fragment actually just went into second edition. It's available on Amazon. I think there's a few copies of the first edition left, very few, and then the second edition is now available. And my Coney Island book is also still in print and available on Amazon. So if someone's interested in seeing the work that has sort of been more, you know, traditionally speaking, my work, that's probably the best way to see it.
Yeah, we'll definitely put links to both of those books, of course, and to your Instagram in the article.
Yeah, great.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you taking the time, and I'm just really glad to connect again.
Yeah, same here, Bob. I've enjoyed the conversation. I think we, very naturally got into some interesting angles, and then hopefully someone listening will take some food for thought away from the conversation.